you so much for listening to this episode of That Gabby Roslin Podcast. This week, I chat to the extremely talented novelist Matt Haig. He's the number one trending author in the world right now for his book, The Midnight Library, which I adore. What a brilliant book. He also wrote Reasons to Stay Alive, How to Stop Time, and the international bestseller, A Boy Called Christmas, which is now going to be a film starring Dame Maggie Smith, Jim Broadbent, and loads of big names for Christmas 2021. We chat about all of that, plus growing up in a small town of Newark-on-Trent, Marmite and peanut butter, and actually lots of food chat, to be honest, and the power of words, even when he's just writing a to-do list. Now, please, can I ask you a favour? Would you mind, please, subscribing by pressing the subscribe or follow button on the show? And then, if you wouldn't mind, rate and review on Apple Podcasts, which is the purple app on your iPhone or iPad. You simply scroll down to the bottom of all of the episodes and you'll see the stars where you can tap to rate and press write a review. It would mean the world to us. Thank you so much.
Hi, Gabby.
Hello, Matt.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You know that I absolutely love and adore you, and I love your writing. And you've become, what is it, the number one trending author for the Midnight Library in the world?
Yes, apparently, which is certainly, yes, English speaking, yes. So that's kind of surreal.
I mean, that's just mad.
I try and stay grateful and remember that, you know, this is good when this happens and it's not normal, and so enjoy it while it's here.
How do you celebrate? How do you peak that enjoyment? Because I know you're all about living in the moment. So let's talk about it as being in the moment. How did you scream at your wife and in the nice way, go, oh my God, look what I've just seen? Or did you just calmly, as I imagine you calmly sitting there and coming out with a brilliant phrase that we can all then like on Instagram and go, you are our God? You know, how did you do it?
With that one, that was very nice, because it came from America. The difference with this book is it's sort of like it's found an American audience as well, which I've never had before. I've been published in America loads, but normally generally ignored. And the fact that, you know, it, reaching over there feels very nice. I didn't do any screaming. I didn't do any champagne cork popping or anything like that. It was a very sort of subdued 2021 style absorption.
Sounds perfect to me. Sounds absolutely perfect. Well, you know what? We should start with that book, because you know what a huge fan I am of it. I bought it for so many friends. I've read it through twice. And when I finished it the first time, for anybody who hasn't read The Midnight Library, this is me saying it absolutely from my heart. Buy it, devour it, read it, take your time with it, and then read it again. It is extraordinary. So that's the embarrassment. Now I know I can feel you blushing, which is very sweet. I really can. But it does make you think about how to discover the best way to live, and thinking back on all of those moments in life. It's an extraordinary book. You get lost in it. Is that how you write and why you write? Because you want people to become lost in your thoughts, in your world?
Well, yeah. I mean, I suppose with The Midnight Library, I wrote it almost as self-therapy, really, for me. I mean, I think you can never mind read another reader. The only reader you're ever going to truly know as a writer is yourself. So you have to write very true to yourself, and you have to write the book that you want to read in that moment, the book that doesn't quite exist but that you would like to pull off the shelf. That's the sort of aim. And with The Midnight Library, yeah, I mean, I was someone who, you know, when I had quite severe depression, well, very severe depression in my 20s and panic disorder, and I was suicidal and everything. One feature of all that horrible experience for me was a sense, a really deep, almost physical sense of regret, of, you know, how did I end up here? Why did this happen to me? All that kind of melodramatic stuff that goes through your head, quite self-indulgent in the way that mental illness can make you feel, because you're just literally wrapped up in yourself. And I just always thought, oh, is there another timeline where I'd done something differently and my mind ended up in a different place? And that was always a feature of mental illness for me. And now, obviously, in the modern world, we kind of live in an age of comparison, where not just how else we could have lived our own life, but we're seeing examples, for instance, on social media. You know, you'll scroll through in the morning, lots of lovely posts. And even during lockdown, even during the sort of pandemic era, you're seeing lots of different alternative ways humans can live or spend their lockdown or do things, you know, in different parts of the world. And so we're constantly or subconsciously comparing ourselves or thinking about other alternatives, you know, not always in a, oh, I wish I was doing that, but inevitably, our brains are sort of overloaded with options of how to live. And I think that can sometimes be a bit paralyzing. So I suppose in the Midnight Library, I was trying to write to myself as much as anyone about acceptance and about gratitude for the life you're in. And I've realized in my own life of, you know, 45 years of being on Earth, that my career and my relationship life and all kinds of things have been in very different, like most lives, have been in very different places at very different times, you know, whether that's financially, whether that's in terms of location and moving around the country or whatever it is. And you slowly learn as you get older that very often the things you think that will make your life absolutely complete or perfect, when you get them, you realize that actually not that much has fundamentally changed, because wherever you go, you are taking yourself with you. And so really, rather than trying to always see happiness as some external thing that you just need to get hold of this, or you just need, I don't know, a record deal from Simon Cowell, or you need this or that or the other to achieve something, it starts with yourself fundamentally. You know, the way you can be in the most beautiful location on Earth. You know, when I was at my very lowest point in life, when I was suicidal, when I was 24 years old, I was living in Spain. I was in the Balearics. I was in Ibiza, in the quiet part of Ibiza, in this beautiful villa. And, you know, the most gorgeous, glittering view of the Mediterranean Sea. And none of that meant anything. You know, when you're in a state of continual depression, none of that fixed anything. You know, I would have much rather have been somewhere very sort of bleak and cold and not feeling like that. So it's never quite the external thing. Obviously, we need the external things. We need comfort and it's nice to want things, but they're not the magic fix. And actually looking at our own lives and reinterpreting our own lives can be very valuable, especially nowadays, because I think one silver lining of this very strange time we're living through is that we've all had this compulsory, not entirely wanted, life edit enforced on us, where we've had to actually appreciate what we had before in a way that we didn't always do at the time. So we really know what we value in our life now, because we know what we miss and what we don't miss, if that makes sense.
Oh, it does completely. It's very interesting, though, hearing you saying all of that. It doesn't matter where you are, you know, you say there you were in Spain and you could have been in a grey place. But all the stuff I read about you as a teenager, that was, you were in Sheffield and you just wanted to get away. So did you have that feeling at a young age that happiness would be somewhere else? And now you realise that it's not somewhere else, physically somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, I was born in Sheffield, but then when I was 8 years old, I moved to Newark-on-Trent. And no offence to Newark-on-Trent, but it's a market, for those that don't know, it's a market town in Nottinghamshire with a population of 40,000 people. And it's got a lot better and it's got a lot of stuff there now. But at the time, in the 1980s, it was the archetypal small town where culturally there wasn't anything going on. I mean, we didn't have a cinema. We didn't have a bookshop.
No bookshop. No, see that bit. That's the bit that makes me go, whoa, no bookshop. Oh, gosh. Was there a library?
I think we had a W.H. Smith's, but a very, very meagre selection of books was available. And then we did have a library. We had a Newark-on-Trent, still to this day, has a very nice library, which is like a greenhouse. It's all glass walled and it's very light and bright, and it's a lovely little thing. And I spent a lot of time there. But no, and at the time, being a typical teenager in quite a small town, I just wanted to escape. I can always remember, and it might be not a real thing she said, but I read in something like, I don't know, can you remember Lookin magazine or one of those?
Yeah, la 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 la, Lookin.
Yes. Well, it was mentioned that Madonna, on her first trip to New York, said, take me to the center of everything. And they took her to Times Square or something. And that quote always stayed in my head as a teenager. I just wanted to be in the center of everything and all the buzz and life. And yes, Newark-on-Trent did not feel in the 1980s like it was the center of everything. But then as you go older, you realize that actually, you know, it's your mind. Your mind, you can have any kind of life, really, but not the extremes of extreme poverty or horrible lives or, you know, extreme billionaire lives, but most lives that sort of fall somewhere in the middle, that they know, you know, they all know suffering to some degree, they all know happiness to some degree, they all know those sort of neutral states to some degree, they all know, you know, it's all there, really. And I feel like we're encouraged to always strive for something that we don't have, and ultimately that makes us feel unnecessarily bad about the life we're stuck in. So yeah, the Midnight Library was kind of my way to address that feeling.
It's very interesting because I have this conversation with a lot of people, because I'm I was brought up by very supportive parents who completely supported my choice to be a TV presenter, my dream. It was my dream from tiny. So listening to how you speak and reading your words and devouring your books, do you believe in dreams then? Do you think dreams are attainable? And once you reach the dream, do the dreams keep growing? Or are you saying there's no such thing as a dream? Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, I definitely think you need forward momentum, and you definitely need to have things to sort of strive towards. And to be honest, that was one of the things that helped me pull out of depression, was sort of wanting to be a writer. And, you know, I went through a phase where the dream was so strong that I didn't even mind the rejection letters. I saw it all as part of the journey.
Yes. So I had, yes, like, yes, I get that. That's
I
fantastic.
Had like,
yeah,
50 rejection letters, and I just saw it as a chapter in the journey. You know, I was so determined, you know, as a 20 something person who just sort of recovered from depression. So I'm not saying that. I'm saying that we're kind of, it's when we feel nothing but a lack. I feel like, you know, life should be an adventure where we're sort of able to sort of do two things at once. We were able to sort of envision a future that we want to work towards, but also at the same time, not in doing that, absolutely hate the present we are in, but see it as part of that process. You know, it's sort of like having your foot in two places at once. And I think as human beings, we do have that ability to actually be grateful in the present, but still have dreams we want to fulfill and doing that. And as a teenager, I was a typical sort of morose teenager who wasn't happy in the present. I wasn't diagnosed with anything then. I know I wasn't really aware of things like depression or anything until I was 24 years old. But I do think I spent too much of my time not living in the present at all, and always sort of like having some, I don't know, normal fantasy of being in Duran Duran or something, and, you know, not actually.
Why not?
Yeah, I think, I won't embarrass you with my story.
No, go on. Yes.
When I was 9 years old, me and my sister were in we recorded some music, and I phoned up EMI to see if I, so I had very early delusions of grandeur.
Have you got that recording still?
No.
Oh, that's such a shame.
Not.
Oh, I love that.
Sorry.
Love that.
Yeah, so I was an early ambitious megalomaniac.
I picked out some wonderful quotes that I found. So I'm going to throw these back at you. That you might not have said them. But I saw in Vogue that you said that the future is open and that people are good. And this was in an article that you wrote for Vogue. And those two things, when I read them yesterday, I was shouting them around the house. I said, you know, just remember, the future is open and people are good. And it just felt so apt for right now. It really did. It's so simple. Those two lines are so simple.
Well, I always think, like, you can see things almost how you want to see them. Like, of course, you can go through your whole life and just focus on the misery and the sort of bad stuff. And you know, often, you know, with the news coverage and whatever it is, we're kind of encouraged to do that a bit. But it's also how you frame it. I think on an individual level, you know, over this last year, amid all the bad news, on my little community around me and my street where we live and stuff, I feel like people are actually, you know, it's bringing out the best in people. You know, I didn't actually know my neighbors' names over a year ago, and now know them quite well in a socially distanced way, you know, across the street and all of that stuff. But, you know, and I feel like in a very strange way, this sort of forced being apart has made us value other human beings more and care about people more, if anything. And so hopefully, you know, once this is all over, which is hopefully soon, it will be nice to take some of that with us.
I've always been a believer that people are good. I don't start with the premise that somebody is bad and they have to prove that they're good. I start with that everybody's good.
Yes, exactly. And also, importantly, you know, because we're human beings and not every single action we do, you know, we have moments of weakness. There are things that people do in their life that aren't their best selves. There are moments where someone swipes out on the internet and it might not actually be themselves. So I feel like alongside that, we've also got to sort of develop like a kind of self-forgiveness or acceptance, because the risk is if a child is told they're a bad person over and over and over again, they become to sort of identify themselves as a bad person. So one reason to sort of see people as essentially good is it actually leads to more goodness, I think. I think once you start having a more hopeful, optimistic outlook on life, you see that hope and optimism everywhere, and it also brings it out in other people. It's like if you're a very, very cynically minded person, then you can see reasons for your cynicism everywhere. But if alternatively, if you're an optimistic person, you can see reasons for optimism somewhere. And I, to be perfectly frank with you, Gabby, I used to be quite a pessimistic person because I was going through depression, and that's a kind of symptom of depression. And in a very strange way, my experience of depression, or rather my recovery from depression, that actually made me an optimist, because the things my mind was telling me at my worst point in life largely turned out to be false, turned out to be lies. You know, I go back to me at 24, I absolutely was convinced nothing good would happen in my life. I was convinced that Andrew and my partner would leave me. I was convinced that I'd be, you know, this sounds bleak, but I was convinced I wouldn't live to be 25 years old, because every day was such a battle to get through. I was convinced of very, you know, and when I say convinced, I really mean that. I literally thought there was no future. And I think that's the difference between anxiety and depression. Anxiety is where you're worried about the future, whereas depression is almost like where you know everything's going to be terrible and awful and all those things. And so when you start to recover, when you start to see the sort of sunlight through the clouds, and you start to have moments, not necessarily of happiness, but of neutrality, where you're not feeling as bleak as you did, then that opens up this sort of world of possibility. And you think, hold on a minute, actually, you know, hope is as real, if not more real, and pessimism, and actually it's got a use. You know, if you've got a choice between optimism and pessimism, you know, I'd go for optimism, because at least even if it's wrong, it's useful and it can get you through things, whereas pessimism, you know, not so much. So in a very strange way, after that moment, I became almost like a evangelical optimist, because where I could do anything, or, you know, see any possibility, because I'd done something which had felt impossible, which was, it sounds melodramatic again, but it was to stay alive, felt like it was impossible. And then you did that. And then other things like, oh, I want to publish a book or whatever, that seems like immediately doable because you've done something which felt impossible.
Well, you're talking to the person who's been an eternal optimist. And I mean, for years, it's very interesting, because for years and years and years, I've said this quite often, but for years and years and years, I was by press and by people in the street, they go, oh, you can't always really be that happy. That's not real. That's not, are you always smiling? Why are you? And I used to say, sorry. Because I had suddenly felt guilty. I thought, oh, I'm so sorry I'm happy. But now it's as if there's been a shift. I feel that there's a shift in the world, and I don't just mean through the pandemic at all. But I think over the past few years, there's a shift that people accept positivity and happiness and kindness, and they don't see it as a weakness. And it's weird that it used to be seen as a weakness.
Yeah, I know. And I feel like, you know, almost people are afraid of it somehow. Like it's like a defense mechanism. Like they don't dare be hopeful or happy because then their life might be even crueler to them or something. But actually, I find that once you have that outlook or try to cultivate that outlook, then actually that leads to other good things happening, and it takes you out of your shell, and it's probably mentally and physically a lot healthier to have that approach anyway. And that doesn't mean, you know, bad things don't happen or there's a, it just me it just I think sometimes hope isn't about actually thinking everything's going to be perfect or everything's going to be beautiful. Hope is about thinking, well, whatever happens, I'm going to survive this or get through this, or it won't necessarily be as bad as I thought. You know, like, it's about reframing things, I think, because we take a word like uncertainty, and like uncertainty has been so used in the last year in the news and so, you know, there's uncertainty in the air, and we're so conditioned, I think, to see uncertainty as a bad thing. And actually, uncertainty, you can reframe uncertainty, because life is uncertain, to actually say, well, actually it's good, because it means that bad thing that's coming up in the calendar or this, that and the other, you know, there's something uncertain about it. I don't know. It might lead to something good that I can't foresee. It might lead to a friendship that I don't have yet. It might lead to me becoming a stronger person. It might lead to something else. You know, like, the very worst experiences of my life have often been the ones that either made me a better person or helped me develop a friendship or managed to sort of turn them into something in a creative way or whatever. And so you never know, however bad a present moment is, how fertile that will prove to be in the future. I'm a great lover. As you've read my books, you probably know this. I love, probably too much, I love metaphors. So I love sort of seeing a metaphor in things. But I love the metaphor about a volcano, you know, because I was lucky enough to go to Hawaii 2 years ago and walked up the volcanoes there. And I'm really into the idea of volcanoes. And what's fascinating about volcanoes is because they're big, scary things that can erupt and lead to all this devastation. But actually, places which have volcanoes, they're like the lushest places on earth. They've got the most life and biodiversity of anywhere on earth. And volcanic ash sort of leads to the most fertile, beautiful soil. So I see that as a metaphor for me. For me, who, when I had a full-blown breakdown, which kind of felt like a sort of volcanic eruption of sort of mental health nightmares, in its wake, it kind of led to sort of beautiful things and senses of gratitude at sort of normal life, the normal life I'd been bored with before, and appreciation of small things, which I never had because of that volcano going off. So often it's the very worst things in life that somehow the silver lining really is bright and dazzling. And
have you seen the David Attenborough, where about the volcano?
I haven't. I don't need to. It's on our iPlayer. We're trying to catch up with all our David Attenborough stuff because I've got a daughter who is David Attenborough super fan.
Watch it tonight. I mean, I will, just because it's exactly what you said. And we all sat here as a family watching it, and I never really put that, you've just put into words exactly what that program's all about. You've got to watch it tonight,
okay,
with the family.
Oh, right.
It's
mind-blowing. We will watch it.
Absolutely mind-blowing. Aren't words amazing, though? Because it's very interesting. You said if you have uncertainty and people see the negative connotation of it, it's interesting that a lot of people keep saying, I wish they had a different word for lockdown, because lockdown is so negative. It just means that's it. You can't do anything. But maybe there's a way of looking at that word and turning it around and trying to make it into a positive word. Just the simple words, because that's what you do with words. You change a word.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the words, exactly, the language of COVID, the lockdown, isolation, all of that stuff. Whereas it's a kind of, you know, it's a reset, it's hibernation. I mean, it's obviously, lockdown is very different for different people.
Absolutely, of course.
I'm lucky to sort of live with other people. And I feel like one thing that's been quite important for me has been that I actually realized that some of the ways I've been living before I don't actually need desperately to return to. I don't need to return to, you know, packed trains to London and bustling crowds. As someone who always gets a little bit of anxiety around lots of people, you know, there's been aspects of it. I'd say, obviously, there's been more aspects that I want to return to. And, you know, as a cinema fan, as a theatre fan, as a holiday fan, as a hug my parents fan, I am very much missing all that stuff. But it's also been a chance to sort of reevaluate what you do really miss and what you might not miss so much.
Some of the things that you love, you can't miss, because I presume you have Marmite and peanut butter at home.
Yeah.
Is that right? It's one of your absolute passions.
Yeah, absolutely. This goes all the way back to my childhood and like my grandma. And I used to think I was the only person in the world who did this. But now you can even buy Marmite peanut butter as a thing. So that was my moment, actually, where I decided, actually, probably the best thing in life is to be a social media influencer, because I got sent free Marmite peanut butter. And I thought, okay, screw this. I'm just going to, you know, head to the beach with my Marmite and peanut butter.
Because I can't eat bread because I have a proper gluten. I'm properly allergic. Not just a trendy thing. I'm properly allergic. I get ill. But there is nothing greater than you see. Now I've said it, I now crave Marmite and peanut butter. We used to just mix it together. I think that buying it ready mixed, it's not the same. Doesn't do the same thing for me.
It's not Marmite-y enough for me. I mean, I love Marmite. And I used to come home, you know, the one highlight of being a teenager in Newark-on-Trent, which I could have done anyway, really, I came home and had a triple-decker Marmite and peanut butter sandwich after school. And yeah, it was a bit gross probably, but...
Do you ever have it by the spoonful?
On its own? I have done. I mean, that, even for me, that is pushing it. Do you do that?
I have done it. I've had to do it on television because I used to go on and on about how much I love it. And then I had to have a spoonful of pick-a-lily afterwards because I love pick-a-lily. Do you like pick-a-lily?
I do like pick-a-lily. I love anything pickly, basically.
Same here.
I love salty stuff. Last night we had curry night, and the good thing about curry night is we get all the pickles out of the thing. If I'm seeing your lime pickles and your mango chutneys, and you know, I'm in heaven with condiments.
Everywhere. Oh, me too. I have to say have you tried, the Barry Norman pickled onions?
For Barry Norman pickled onions?
Barry Norman. I'm sure it's Barry. Yeah, Barry Norman, who used to do film. Yeah.
Film whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. There used to be, because I'm literally, and this is really embarrassing, and they've tested me on live television about this, but if you start talking about pickles, my mouth starts watering. I have anything fermented, anything pickled, yeah. I love it.
That's
it. Our night out sorted.
Yeah, you know, no one will come near us because of our breath, but you know, yeah, just
pickled garlic. Now that's a thing.
Yeah.
Oh, I love pickled garlic.
I'm not a massively amazing chef, but I've been doing a lot of cooking in this year as something to do. I've been doing a lot of cooking. And my one gripe with most cookery books is they only ever never have more than 2 cloves of garlic in any recipe.
I saw you writing about
it. I see 2 cloves of garlic and I think, no, they mean 10. They mean 10 cloves of garlic. Or they might mean 2 bulbs. So change the word cloves to bulbs.
That's exactly what I do. exactly the same. I don't understand it. But I put garlic in everything. I literally put garlic in everything. And then I went to a place. There used to be a place in Soho where you could get garlic. And they even had garlic ice cream. And everyone said, you're not going to try. I did. It was nice.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I've had some savoury. We went in the days when you could go to a foreign country, went to a Lyon in France, and they've got the craziest ice cream shop there. I think they had courgette ice cream, for instance. They had everything. I mean, and most of it probably I didn't particularly fancy. The nicest ice cream I ever had, which is kind of a sweet ice cream, was there's a place in Brighton, Boho Gelato. I'll just give them a plug. And they sell rose and lychee sorbet, and it's just divine.
Oh, now you see, you're just my two favourite things, pickles and ice cream. And last summer for my birthday, my husband bought me my very own ice cream machine. I cannot tell you what a joy it was. My favourite is either pistachio or banana. So I thought I'd put the two together.
Oh, it's good. Yeah, I can imagine that, actually. Yes. Yes, I'd like that. Pistachio used to be my ultimate go-to. Yeah, pistachio and banana. That would definitely work.
Give it a go. Trust me, that, watching the volcanoes eating pistachio and banana ice cream and starting with some pickled onions.
Do you like hummus?
Oh, I love it. Have you tried the beetroot one?
I have tried the beetroot one. I make my own hummus now. This is what I do on a Saturday, because it's super easy making hummus. And because it's not proper cooking. You're not really cooking. You're just mixing and mashing everything together. And I do a really nice red pepper hummus. So I just wanted to show off about that.
Okay, no, do. Because when I try and make it at home, it's so dry that it sticks my teeth together.
You need to put a little bit of water in there, ton of oil and lemon juice for the texture.
And lots of garlic.
Yeah, I'm going to do a cookbook next, I'm sure.
You and Charlie McAsey, and I quote you two together.
I love Charlie.
And I hope you don't mind that. And Charlie was a guest on this, and it's such an amazing person to chat to, as are you. And I think the two of you, I keep saying it, the two of you have got to do something together. It feels so right that you do, that it would just make sense.
I'd love that. I think Charlie's amazing. I love how atmospheric his pictures are. And I feel like what I like about Charlie is that they're not just sort of like, he always, they're very stormy, his pictures. So it's always about going through something. It's not saying, as I was just saying before, it's not about saying everything's going to be all right and everything's going to be rainbows and unicorns. It's about actually saying, whatever happens, whatever storm this is, we will hold our hands and we will be together and we will get through this. And I think that's been the message of this year, because obviously not everything's perfect, not everything's brilliant, but going through it. Yeah, I think Charlie's brilliant, and he's had an incredible success with this book, and justifiably, because he's just, he's been great.
You both have. And that's why you two should do something together. But it's extraordinary that, I wonder if you looked at the followers on social media that you have and that he has, I bet it would be the same people. Because I'm always reposting your quotes, because you just, it's quite bizarre. You know how to get into people's heads. And you know exactly, and I mean that as a compliment. I don't mean, you're not in Doctor Who taking over our minds.
I'm hypnotizing the world.
You're taking over. But you, with your quotes, you just know the right time to put them out. And do you plan them? I'm just quite fascinated to know.
No.
Oh, you don't. You just write it and go.
I'm not a planner. I know there are things you can do, like on social media, where you can actually time things and you can write things. But there's not too much thought in it, really. I think that's the best way to do it, really. Because if you're feeling something at that moment and you're being true about what you're feeling, or you're being true about what you want to hear, then there's a good chance in that same moment there will be someone else who wants to hear that thing, and that it gives them some comfort too. So I think, I try and be as natural as possible. I sometimes repeat things that I've said before and things that I'm feeling again or whatever. But no, when I'm posting something new up, I'm genuinely feeling it in that moment. Yes.
It's interesting, because I've also read that you're a list maker. So that's why I thought you might be quite organized and planning.
Well, I do. I like lists. I like lists. But the reason I like lists is that easy. They're easy to read and kind of easy to write, and they're very easy to focus your mind. I can remember, actually, because although I had depression, I was simultaneously diagnosed with panic disorder, which is a very sort of extreme state of anxiety. And one of the things that made it difficult to do was to read. Like, it was really very hard for me for a good 3 or 4 years to actually concentrate and focus on things. So as someone who's always liked to write and always liked to read, I really realized that things like lists and things that like quotations and little short, like inspiring quotes, those things can really sort of still get in, whatever state your head's at. Those sort of things can actually focus your concentration. And so I think one thing I have in mind when I'm writing these sort of very short form things, whether it's lists or little Instagram quotes or whatever, is I remember myself when I couldn't really concentrate on that much, and then trying to think, how do you make someone who's in that state of mind, how do you get through to someone who might be feeling really bad in that moment? How do you actually sort of hack into that brain and make them sort of focus on stuff? So that's what I have in mind sometimes, and lists are a good way. I don't know what it is about a list. Maybe it's just the way it's laid out, but it's a good way to sort of focus your brain.
I'm going to start. I've never done it. My husband does. He has his list and he ticks it off in the day. I've never done that. I sort of just go through it.
Yeah, I'm not that sort of person. Like Andrea, my wife, she literally, if she's got any work to do, the first thing it becomes is a list, and then it is literally procedural. She'll go through it and do it. And I would love to be that organized. Lists for me are more a way of sort of like collecting your thoughts together, like, you know, so it'll be a vague list about, you know, so I did sort of 10 lockdown tips or 10 anxiety tips or whatever, and it's just a way to focus my thoughts, probably because my thoughts need a bit of organization, but it's not necessarily something I will then do as a, unless it's a recipe, and then I'll go for it and then trip over garlic and add a bit of Marmite, and then we'll
and you have to write it all down for your book, for your recipe book. Can we talk your books turning into films? Because how does that feel? So we've all seen the trails because it's been released for Father Christmas and Me with Dame Maggie Smith. I mean, what a cast as well in it. But how does it feel? And I know all the stuff about How to Stop Time and Benedict Cumberbatch, but how does it feel seeing your words coming to life? Because it's in your head, and these characters are in your head and how you picture them. And because I love books. I devour books. I love books. I've got so many next to my bed. I always loved it. I love working with the Book Trust. I just think books are magical.
Oh, yeah, they're great.
And so many charities who supply books to people who don't have them, because I think books as a child are just keeps your imagination.
Yes. Yeah, Book Trust and Reading Agency. We're very lucky in Britain that we've got a lot of great organisations and charities that really encourage reading and a democratic approach to reading. You know, reading is for everybody. And I think sometimes my only gripe with book culture in this country is that it sometimes becomes a slightly snobby thing, or, you know, this idea that books are define you as a type of person.
Yes.
And that, and people grow up through the education system thinking, oh, I'm not a book person. And it's like, you know, there's no, you know, everyone can be a book person, you know. And I feel like, you know, even if you're watching wall-to-wall Netflix, you know, half the things you're watching possibly started off as books, and you know, every drama you watch starts off as words on a page. So I feel like everybody is kind of a book person, but I feel like some people feel a bit shut out from the world of books, and that's, you know, something we need to address.
I completely agree with you, and it drives that actually. I can start ranting about it, but I won't. But it drives me mad where somebody puts somebody else down. You mean you haven't read that? Oh, you've read that? Oh, is that what you? I remember my mum, when I was reading really trashy novels as a teenager, and I devoured them. I absolutely devoured them. And I remember my mum once coming in. She just put it's a completely true story, and she put Wuthering Heights down. I said, "What? Why have you given me that?" She said, "Carry on reading what you're doing, but I'm just putting this book here." So I went, oh, she never said don't read those books, but she also gave me that. So I then picked it up, I read it and thought, oh, that's incredible. And then I went back to my trashy novels, and then she did it again. But she was never saying to me, that's disgusting, don't read that rubbish. She just liked the fact I was reading, there were words, and I could picture,
yes,
you know, I could have my imagination.
Because I think the one thing that puts, like, you know, because I know the teenage years is an age that a lot of people fall out of reading, is when it's presented as this very, very sort of like too earnest, it's almost like it's a whole grain cereal that's there to do you good, but it might be a bit dull.
Yeah.
And actually, you know, books can be a sort of radical, exciting, invigorating as any sort of film or TV show or song or whatever, and you know, they're just an entertainment form at the end of the day, and we can get a lot of information and inspiration from them, but they're also there to entertain us as well as enlighten us. So yeah, I'm a big ranter about sort of book snobbery, and about, you know, and there is a lot of snobbery in the book industry that's not often always admitted. But yeah, I think this sort of idea of a class system of books is a bit silly and old-fashioned now. And I feel like we are actually, one of the good things about social media and the internet is it's encouraged readers from everywhere and all types of things. And one thing about this last year is, you know, although a lot of the arts and culture sector has been so badly hit, people have been turning to books, and books in some quarters are kind of thriving right now, because I think, you know, people don't just want to be on their phones all day, don't just want to be on TV today. They want a space for reflection and to actually have a bit of quiet time, a bit of a communication with an author. And that's a kind of therapeutic thing, I think.
Yes, I want to go back to your books as films. So when you see the films, how does that feel? Because these people were in your head. You knew them so well. You could picture their faces, their expressions, their words. You heard their sounds, their voices. How is it to see it then played out in front of you?
Yes, well, the one I've seen, the ones that's finished, that's coming out this year, A Boy Called Christmas, the kids' one, and that is, well, they've done an amazing job, and it is totally surreal to see someone like Maggie Smith or Sally Hawkins or whoever reading, well, saying words that started off in your head that you wrote down, wondering even if a book would be published, let alone that anyone would read it, let alone that anyone would speak it, let alone it would be those speaking it. And it was just like, yeah, that totally surreal. What was even more surreal was actually with that film, I went on to Prague where they filmed it, and they'd built the whole elf village out of wood, and you were walking around a world that you'd written about in just about two or three sentences. And out of that, they'd built this whole place, and people were going around, you know, there's these sort of extras from the Czech Republic who were going around dressed as elves and stuff, and you're walking around thinking, oh my goodness, I started all this. This is crazy. And yes, that was very surreal, because most of the time, even when you're getting lots of good news and praise and people saying nice things happen, generally as a writer, you're still at home with your laptop and nothing's changing. But when you actually went on the film set, you thought, oh my goodness, this is something I created, that's helped create, and it's out there. Very surreal and very lovely.
Oh, well, good. Surreal in a good way.
Surreal in a good way. But it was kind of like, yeah, I was a little bit speechless when I saw it, because it was it was great the way they've done it. I mean, it's actually probably better than I could have imagined, because they're obviously getting the best set designers and things like that. So you think, oh yeah, okay, I'll take credit for this. But yeah, this is great what you've done with it. But yeah, so actually, I genuinely feel like with this one, they've been so true to the book, and they've kept me in the loop so nicely about it. Actually feels like a film that's been made for the right reasons, and I genuinely think people will like it when they see it. So I am excited.
I can't wait. But Midnight Library, surely that's going to be a film. I mean, it is... I read it as a film, if you see what I mean.
Hopefully, that would be nice. The film rights have been sold, so we will see. But, you know, this is such a strange, weird time for filmmaking and filmmakers. But yes, all being well, hopefully something will happen. But I also learned a long time ago, for my own sanity's sake, not to realise that just because you've sort of given someone the film rights or something, that means a film will be happening. I can remember my very first book. This is a total name droppy and show offy, but my very first book was optioned by Brad Pitt.
Oh,
Brad Pitt's
word.
Film company. And this was when I was like, no one had read me at all. This was when I was, back living in a flat in Leeds and struggling to pay the rent. And my first book, which was called The Last Family in England, you know, I suddenly got this news that Brad Pitt optioned me. And I literally thought, okay, by the end of the year, I'd be in Malibu, I'd be retired. There'd be red carpets galore, and you know, that. And that wasn't the reality at all. And that never ended up happening. But I feel like, again, going back to that thing about sort of how disappointments and stuff, you can reframe them. I'm so thankful in a way that I sort of took a kind of long, winding route with my books. You know, Midnight Library, it was funny the other day, someone called it an overnight success. The Midnight Library was like book number 16. So I've definitely paid my dues as the sort of struggling writer, and I've learned a lot of lessons, and I've learned about how to be grateful for things and what's not normal and what is normal. So
who would you cast in it, though? Because I love those casting games. Have you must have people in mind for the Midnight Library?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I mean, the audio, we were incredibly lucky with the audiobook that they got Carey Mulligan to read the audiobook, and I think she'd be great as Nora, because she's at the right sort of age and right sort of person to do that. I haven't been watching too much telly, actually, recently, because I've been so busy making my hummus and my peanut butter sandwiches that I've not
had. And your loads of garlic.
My Instagram quotes, yes.
Can I ask you, because I ask everybody in this podcast, what makes you properly laugh? Because I can tell you love a giggle.
My daughter is crazy, and she makes me laugh quite a lot. And I feel like children's sense of humour, it's just so funny, but a fresh rate. I'm trying to think of, well, for instance, I don't know if, have you ever seen Hamilton the musical?
Yes, I have.
Have you seen, yes, well, about Alexander Hamilton. Well, my daughter wants to have a hamster just so she can call the hamster Alexander Hamsterton.
I like that.
She wants a cat called Aaron Purr. And she's gone through the whole Hamilton cast and how she would do that. So yes, my daughter always makes me chuckle. I'm a sucker for a good, Elf. Elf always makes me laugh. We watched Elf of a gazillionth time over Christmas. And something about Will Ferrell and, you know, whether he's jumping on a like Christmas tree or a snowball fight or whatever it is, there's so many scenes in that film. I'm just quite deeply immature. So any of those sort of like lowbrow comedy American stuff, you know, I'll be laughing at. But, you know, and I'm really trying to rack my brains, because me and my wife giggled like little kids the other day over something. I can't remember, but I just remember how good it feels to have a prop. You know, when you just can't, when you can't straighten your face and you feel like you're a naughty school child again. That is just, yeah, that's the great, when you can still do that.
That's me most of the time. I'm like a naughty school child. The laughter is the best thing. It is just
so good.
It just brings joy, and it also passes on. Because you can start laughing. So if you started laughing now, I'd laugh and I wouldn't know what you were laughing
about.
Yeah,
it's contagious.
And then the next person would laugh, and the next person. I love it. I absolutely love it. I just want to end on one other quote, if you don't mind, which I loved. And you said that you want to believe in the possibilities of change. And I know that we've mentioned it before, but what for you, because you're very grateful for being in the moment and everything, but for you, is there anything that you still are open to change about, or that you would like to change, or that you're thinking may change? Do you see what I just want to end on that, if that's
yes right. Well, I think you know, change is the nature of life. My favorite quote of all quotes is a quote I only heard for the first time this year, and it's by a very, very ancient Greek philosopher, like before Socrates, like before philosophy was a thing, right? This guy called Heraclitus. And he said, no man, because they always spoke about men, but no person, no man steps into the same river twice, because it's not the same river and it's not the same man. And that is one of those mind-boggling quotes, and you start to think what it's about. But it's about how actually life is change. We change all the time. So when we're facing a moment of difficulty, it's important to know that this won't be forever. This won't be the moment we're stuck in forever. And we change and we evolve. And yes, there's a sort of scary and uncertain side to that, but there's also a very positive and hopeful side to that. And the hardest question I ever got asked at an event about mental health was, someone said, well, you know, it was kind of okay for you because you had a bit of support. You had your family around you when you were ill. You had a partner. And what would you say to somebody who felt that low as you did in that situation, who felt like they had no one? And I feel like in a very strange way, the answer is still to stay around for other people. It's just that those other people are the people you haven't met yet. They're the people you're going to become, because there's this wonderful term in science called neuroplasticity. And what neuroplasticity is, it's the way our minds change through living, through our experiences, through what we read, through who we interact with, through life itself. So just as all of us would say we're a slightly different person to who we were as a child or a teenager or when we were 21, we're continually, that process continues throughout our life. So we're always evolving, we're always changing, and we're always open to the world and new experiences, because we actually are always becoming a new person all the time. And I find that a wonderful, hopeful idea.
What a perfect way to finish this. You know, I think you're a complete joy. Thank you for your beautiful books, and thank you for your beautiful words, and thank you for your inspiration and just for being you. And I'm so damn delighted that at 24 you got that ray of light, because you brought it, you shared it with all of us. So thank you so much, my lovely.
Thank you so much, Gabby, for having me. That was beautiful. It's always lovely to chat to you. You're the best person to chat with. Thank you.
Oh, he says the nicest things. Thank you, Matt. That Gabby Roslin podcast is proudly produced by Cameo Productions. Music by Beth Macari. Please press the subscribe button and it will come straight to your phone on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you choose to listen. Also, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts.